The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
What I'm going to do tonight is really tell you a detective story. And it's a story about how scientists from all around the world came together to understand the transformation of the Arctic to what it was before, something that the explorers of the 19th and 18th centuries would have been very familiar with, to something today that's a very different north, with implications that really reverberate around the globe. Now, I tell this story, and largely from my own perspective. I've been in this business for 35 years, studying the Arctic. That's what I've loved to do. And I was kind of much there at the beginning, when that Arctic of old was still there, and was one of those people who saw it all happen and played a role, and was part of that, part of understanding that. But I think also there's a very important perspective here, that for many years, as a climate scientist, I was actually a skeptic on the idea that human activities could have were having an effect on climate. And that's as a climate scientist. Shows that, you know, we're supposed to be skeptical, right? But then eventually, in light of the overwhelming evidence, I had to turn and accept climate change for what it really is. So that's what this is all about tonight. And the book is upstairs. I hope you have a chance to read it. There I am back then. That's when I kind of first started out in this, quite young, a lot better looking than I am today. And today, somewhat more grizzled and perhaps a little more world-weary at times. But any story has a beginning. And the beginning to my story starts in 1982. So what was going on in 1982? Well, E.T. came out. Now, it was a largely analog world, not for E.T., I suppose. But we had computers and things like that, but there was not much, right? MS-DOS was just coming out, things like that. I think the Falklands War was underway in 1982. But I was a young undergraduate. I was pursuing a bachelor's degree in geography, and I was pretty aimless. I actually started out as an astronomy/physics major, you know, taking all the calculus courses and all this sort of stuff. But for a number of reasons, in hindsight, none of which bear any kind of close scrutiny, I decided instead to go into geography. Right? And I wasn't sure what I was going to do with this. I hadn't really learned enough of any kind of hard science to be employable. Probably only just enough to be, say, irritating to my friends, sort of at that level. So what was I going to do? Well, I'd taken a couple of courses my senior year with this fellow, Ray Bradley, now a well-known climate scientist, does a lot of paleoclimate work. And he said, well, Mark, you know, I'm looking for a field assistant for this spring and summer on some work we're doing way up in the Arctic in the Canadian north, about 82 degrees north on Ellesmere Island. Maybe you'd like to be a part of that. And I saw you did well in this class, so maybe you should try to apply to graduate school as well. So I said, yes, I'll be your field assistant. And I said, sure, I'll apply to graduate student. By some miracle, I was accepted into the graduate school. Actually, I found out the day after we got into the Arctic that I had been accepted. So it was sort of like if I hadn't been, I'm not quite sure what I would have said. But any case, off we go. In 1982. And we left like early May. This is a shot from our little camp up on Ellesmere Island. Ellesmere Island is that big island to the very, it's kind of northwest of Greenland. It's way the heck up there. We were at about 82 degrees north. This is a shot from about, this probably was July after some of the snow had melted off the mountains or the ridges on the right. And that's our little camp. We flew the Canadian flag, of course. This was Canada, right? And that's the little tent that we had. That was both our eating camp and hanging out tent. Basically, you use a Coleman stove back then for both heat and for cooking. And, you know, use it for heat. This is just, you know, Coleman stove. So we weren't concerned about things like carbon monoxide because it was, let's say, well ventilated, the tent. You know, I was 22 years old. It's like gung-ho. There's no problem here. You know, we just do what we do. And what I was doing was, well, I was, as Ray called me, he called me a cub scientist, right? I didn't know enough real science, but I was aspiring and trying to be one. And what we were doing was performing this local test of something that was called instantaneous glacierization. It was an idea put forth by this climate scientist named Jack Ives. And what it had to do was these theory of how the last ice ages in the past could have formed, how these great ice sheets could have formed in the past. Like 25 years ago, right, we had a tremendous ice sheet in North America and also big ones in Eurasia. And the idea behind this theory is that, well, up in Canada, there's this big elevated plateau called the Labrador-Ungava Plateau. And the idea is if the climate cooled for some reason, just a little bit, what would happen is the snow line would drop below the top of the plateau, which meant that snow would survive the summer. Now, snow is very bright, right? It's reflective. It's white. Right? So it has what we call a high albedo. Well, that means that snow, if it persisted, it would tend to cool the climate more. If it cooled the climate more, then more of the snow the next summer would survive, and so on and so on and so on, and the whole thing kind of spirals out of control, and there you've got an ice sheet, you know, a few thousand years later. That was the idea. And what we were doing was trying to look at a little local test of this idea by instrumenting these two little ice caps that were up there, and they're there on the left, you see. That's an actual aerial photograph taken in 1959 by the Royal Canadian Air Force. And so those two little white things in these little ice caps. And we put these instruments on them at these different sites. I kind of got them marked there. And all we were really doing was trying to see if these little ice caps were affecting the local climate somehow, cooling the local climate by being reflective, by all that snow there, and comparing to what was going on the surrounding terrain to see what kind of capture that effect. It's kind of a fun little study. How big were these ice caps? The bigger one was maybe about a mile and a half across, small as ice caps go, but seemingly very permanent things. So it's this idea, this is what we were testing it, this idea of this instantaneous glacierization. And what it was inspired by, in part anyhow, was this idea back then that was still around that we could actually be entering a cooling phase in our climate. Now, back at the time, this is like early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, there were still, of course, a lot of people talking about this idea that the climate should be warming. It should warm as we continue to increase the load of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, which had already been measuring at Mauna Loa for quite some time. There's a lot of talk on that, a lot of work, but there was still some of this talk about maybe entering a cooling climate. And Ray Bradley, the guy I was up there, my advisor, he wrote this paper way back in 1972, and this is what he said: this climate warming trend since the 1880s seems to have given way since the 1940s to cooling, and that cooling most pronounced in the Arctic. Right? So this idea of a cooling phase, and it was kind of overblown or overstated as this idea we're going to go into a new ice age or something like that. You see that Time magazine. Now, I put it up there because it's a fake. Okay, it's a fake. Right? And why would anyone want to fake this? Okay. Well, if you talk about some of the skeptics out there, what they'll be quick to point out is that, well, you climate scientists were saying once that the climate could be entering a cooling phase. Now you're saying it's warming. You know, how should we believe you? So I'm not quite sure how this one came about, okay, but I suspect it has something to do with that sort of thing. Quite clever, I thought. Okay. But, yeah, there was this thinking that maybe we could even be entering a cooling phase, right? Although there was talk, of course, about the idea that we were going to warm up. So I got a little more experience in the field. This back in 1983, I was this field assistant to this fellow named Fritz Kerner, a famous glaciologist from Canada. Glaciologists, they know all about ice. That's their thing. Okay, know all about ice. So this was, oh, I got this grand tour of the Canadian Arctic on all these big ice caps, the Devon Island ice cap, Mer de Glace, Agassiz, all over the place. I went as just his field assistant. Learned a lot, learned always to be prepared, right? Was on the top of Devon Island ice cap. It was like minus 40 with a good breeze, and I thought I was gung-ho, knew everything, and I came and I was not prepared, right? And so you learn all about frostbite, right? Ever since then, whenever I go somewhere in cold weather, I completely over-prepare because I've been there before. I remember I had this ditzy girlfriend at the time, and I come home after this frostbite and sit with my whole face peeling, and she wouldn't go near me for 2 weeks, right? So, you know, lessons learned all over, I suppose. But I learned a lot about the Arctic and about glaciers and ice sheets and things like that. And we went back to that little ice cap the next year, the second year of field work, and this is part of the actual field book that I had. You know, anyone who did field work like this, you have these field books and you guard them jealously. Right? This is my thesis, right? Part of my thesis. I'm going to lose this. One of the things we were doing here was inserting these lines of stakes in the ice cap. We just take a drill, like you see on the right, drill down, and then you'd insert an aluminum pole. And you do this in a whole line. That's kind of the transects that I show there in my field book. And the idea is that if you put those stakes in the ice and you come back and measure year after year after year how much of that stake is showing, you can tell whether that ice cap or glacier is growing or shrinking. This is still the techniques that's used today. It's actually a very low tech. We have satellites that we can do a lot of other things with, but still there's no substitute for going out and putting stakes in the ice, as it turns out. But we had these high hopes that we'd put in this big stake network, and we'd be able to come back year after year after year and see what was going on with the ice caps. But I never went back. Never went back to those little ice caps. I wanted to, but, you know, life gets in the way, things like that. So I wrote a master's thesis on this and went off and started to do other things. And then it was, 2 years ago or so, that I was walking by a colleague of mine at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, who's involved in this big project to map all of the world's glaciers and ice sheets using high-resolution satellite data. So I walked down there. I said, Bruce, why don't we take a look at where those old ice caps are, see what's going on, right? And I kind of knew that they had been shrinking because Ray Bradley, that advisor I had sent some of his later crop of grad students up there to see what was going on. So I knew that they had shrunken since I was there, but we finally found where these ice caps were in this satellite imagery, and we were just floored. We were just floored because they were almost dead. So here they are now. So that blue outline, that's where they were in 1959 when those air photographs were taken. Ray Bradley students went up in 2001 with a GPS and assessed the whole perimeter of these things, and that's in the red. Then we got this high-resolution satellite imagery and could see where they were in 2014, 2015. By 2015, 95% of them was gone. 5% of them was just left. We got some images for this last summer, and there's even less now. All they are little patches of ice now, and they'll be gone in another 3 or 4 years, I think. And this, I mean, I've been doing climate science for all this time, but this is when it really hit home for me, was seeing this. My little ice caps, dead. Now, they weren't mine. They were governed to Canada, actually, but I had a sense of ownership to these sorts of things. And ice caps, they're permanent things, right? Okay, you've probably all seen these images of before and after shots of glaciers and seen the big recession through the 20th century, things like that, as have I. But this is the one that really hit home for me, that made climate change a very, very personal thing for me. So let's go back now. We'll go forward, flash forward here, and see where we are today in the Arctic. What do we see today and what's happened? And then we'll go back and put this in perspective. So certainly the Arctic is nowhere near what it used to be, right? And that's an old shot from back in the early days in the field, 1983, I think. What's happened to the Arctic? One of them, a pronounced warming of the Arctic. I'm not going to show too many graphs and things here because it's not the intent here, but a few of them are very visual, and this is one of them. This is a map of the change in temperature. That's this, what's called a surface air temperature, measured about that high, measured all around the globe. When you look at these records of global air temperature, that's what it's based on. And this is looking at the map of change all around the world between the years 1960 and 2017. So what, better part of 40, 50, better part of 60 years, right? And anywhere in yellow is where it's warmed over that period, and the really warm colors in the red is where it's really, really, really warm. And you can see where it's really, really warm, the Arctic. It's something called Arctic amplification. It even has a name, something that I've studied quite a bit. This was one of the first predictions of climate models. The early climate models, even the very early ones coming out in like the mid-1970s, were saying if things warm up, and there were people very confident in this, right, even though we saw this sort of, you know, temporary cooling, they were saying as things warmed up, it's going to be the Arctic that warms up first. Right? It's exactly what's happened. Actually, it wasn't even the early climate models that said this. Svante Arrhenius in 1896, I believe it was, predicted this. Right? It goes to show you how far back some of this goes. But right now, the Arctic is warming up at twice the rate of the rest of the globe. It's really remarkable. Now, a warming Arctic, there's a lot of implications for that, right? And one of them is a quickly shrinking sea ice cover. So what this is something we do a lot of at our center, is look at sea ice from satellite at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, where as we claim, we even have a T-shirt that says, we are the most trusted name in sea ice, right? Now, what sea ice is a floating ice cover on top of the Arctic Ocean. It ranges from just a veneer of ice, maybe a centimeter thick, and some of that ice could be, in places, even 10 meters thick, you know, 30 feet of ice, something like that. It's quite variable. And anything in white here is where there was sea ice back in September of 84, kind of the beginning of the satellite record, towards the beginning. There we were in 2012, the record low. Compared to where we were in, say, the late 1970s, early 1980s, we probably lost 40% of the ice cover, something like that. Well, there's ups and downs from year to year. We recovered a little after 2001, then we're down again. But there's no sign of a recovery here. Just for perspective, September, that's the sea ice minimum, because the sea ice waxes and wanes with the season. It grows through autumn and winter, gets to a maximum around March, and then it starts to decline again through spring and summer. End of summer, September, that's the end of the melt season. It's the best time of year to look at the overall health of the sea ice cover, because that's one we focus on. But it's been a remarkable loss of sea ice. Coastal erosion is part and parcel of this. This is a shot from the north coast of Alaska. Think about, you know, Barrow, that sort of area. That's Irina Overeem. She works with us quite a bit. And there's places along the Arctic coast where the coastline is now retreating like 15 meters, 30 feet, 40 feet per year. Right? What's happening here is it relates back to the sea ice. It used to be in summer a big storm would come through the Arctic Ocean, but because the sea ice was there, it would act as a lid and it would limit how big the waves would get. But now, you go to Point Barrow, Alaska at the end of summer and look north, and there's open water as far as the eye can see, open water for hundreds of miles, actually, typically. Now a storm comes through, and the waves have this big fetch over water, and you get big waves. The wind has a big fetch over water, and you get big, big waves now. And that's part of this erosion. Now, the other part of it is that the waters are warmer. Now, why the warmer waters matter is because these coastal areas, coastal sediments, is locked together by permafrost. These are permanently frozen soils, right? What we call permafrost. But what happens is now the permafrost is warming, but the water is also warming too, so you get a thermal erosion too. It's thawing, melting the permafrost. So there's a double whammy going on here as well, really a triple whammy, because less sea ice, the waters are warmer, the permafrost itself is thawing. And so that's one of the things that happens because of that. There have been entire villages in Alaska that have had to be moved. The village of Shishmarev voted to move itself because they were eroding into the sea. So, you know, if you're thinking about, well, who's dealing with climate change, if you're living on coastal Alaska, you are on the front lines of it right now. I mentioned thawing permafrost. Most of the Arctic landscape is underlain by frozen soils, called permafrost. And that permafrost across most of the Arctic now is starting to warm and it's starting to thaw. that melts the ground ice that is there underneath. And when that happens, you can get entire collapse of landscapes, such as you see here. You can get buckling roads, things like this. That's something that you see around Fairbanks in areas. It's quite a serious problem. It's going to grow, right? But it's just another indicator of this warming climate that we're seeing. And you've probably heard about this one, the melting Greenland ice sheet, right? Greenland is losing mass, as in basically all Arctic glaciers and ice cap. And basically, this is part of a worldwide signal, actually. So you can always find a few glaciers that are advancing. That's always going to happen. But those are the exceptions that prove the rule, as they say. But the Greenland ice sheet is losing mass, and it's contributing to sea level rise. This makes sense, of course, because the Arctic is warming strongly. Questions out there, you know, how much sea level rise will the melt of Greenland contribute to? What surprises are out there? A lot of things we don't know. But the point is the Arctic is a very different place right now, and it's in a period of rapid transformation. This is going to continue. And it's a very visual picture in many ways. You know, it's easy enough to look at charts and graphs that say, you know, you're losing this much sea ice or it's warming this much. It's a very different thing to go to some place you remember, like your little ice caps, and find that, like, they're gone, right? That's how visual it's gotten. Or go to Point Barrow, Alaska, and look north at the end of summer and see no ice as far as the eye can see. So how did this all start? Where did we start on this whole journey of the Arctic and how it changed, right? Well, all right, so let's go back a bit now, okay? So I'd just gotten out of school, right, 1982, and then I got a master's, got this master's degree, and then I went to University of Colorado, never left, okay? Got my PhD there and pretty much embarked then along this career on Arctic climate science because I just grew in love with the place. And where were we, say, late 1980s, early 1990s? And we flash forward a bit from my start, okay? late 80s, early 90s. And questions people had, where's the warming, right? We're still at this place where, well, we're going to be expecting the Arctic to warm up, but it hadn't, as far as we could see. Now, this is a picture of the temperature change from, I think it's 1950 through 1987, this particular one. So through the mid-1980s. Basically, it's like the last one. The warm colors, the reds and things like that is where it's warming over that period. The blues is where it was cooling. And what do you see? A mix, right? Some areas warming, some areas cooling, right? There's no clear signal here towards warming or a cooling, right? And why would you see a pattern like this? Well, some warming, some cooling. That's just the sort of thing you'd expect by just plain old natural variability in the climate system. Just like out here, right out in the east, you might have a string of winters where you get a lot of nor'easters come through and it's cold and snowy. And then you have another one where it's just warm and maybe rainy, not much happens. This year you got kind of the late nor'easters coming in, right? But that's just an example of the natural variability in the climate system. There's a lot of that, all superimposed now, of course, upon a warming climate, but just natural variability. And this is what that looked like to me, okay? Just there's no need to invoke the specter of the satanic gases, right, to explain this, just plain old natural variability. And now, you may remember this thing, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They've had a whole series of these reports. First one came out in 1990. And it was very guarded with respect to stating the evidence for climate change. It was saying, maybe it is. Maybe it is, just a little bit by now. But they weren't so sure either. Right? So what was going on in the science community? Okay? So Jim Overland, a guy from NOAA who I've worked with for years and years, and he was there before I came in. He's been publishing since the 1970s. He said, like early 1990s, 91, 92, we did not see or think much about Arctic changes. It's all variability, things like that. Marika Holland, I've been working with her for years, and she was just embarking on her career at that point. She was a few years behind me. And she wasn't thinking much about Arctic change. And to her, it just seemed like this faraway thing that people were talking about. But we really didn't see it. And she just really didn't think about it that much. So, you know, that's what kind of a lot of people were thinking back then in terms of the climate science community. We kind of knew this was coming. we expected it to be coming, okay? But it wasn't there yet by any means. So I got a little more experience learning the ropes. This was with a bunch of Canadian grad students in 1991 and 1992. Had a little bit of fun right out there playing golf out on the tundra and the sea ice. Right, you could hit a ball for miles. I just brought an old 9-iron and some orange golf balls, and we spray painted them black. We found out that was more effective. But boy, the thing can go for a mile if you hit it on the ice just right. There'd be one guy with the golf clubs hitting, right? The other person would have a shotgun because there's a lot of polar bears around that way. So it's kind of an odd sight. That's actually, I thought, pretty good form for being bundled up. But it was a lot of, learned a lot about sea ice being up with these guys. And there are certain stereotypes that are true, like never, ever go out drinking with Canadian grad students. Do not do it, okay? It's one of these things you will live to regret it if you try, okay? Their tolerance for cold was exceeded only by their tolerance for alcohol, and I'll say no more. But we had a lot of fun. We were doing all kinds of work on the sea ice, looking at sea ice thickness, melt patterns, things like that. And 1992, we were out there. Along comes Mount Pinatubo. Okay, so we were out there in 1991 doing all these measurements. One of the things we were doing was what we call sun photometer measurements, where we could actually measure the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere. These are like scattering particles. And we did it in 1992 after Pinatubo blew. We were up there in the spring. Pinatubo went up, I think it was July of 91, something like that. And you didn't even have to know that it had blown to see something had happened. The whole color of the sky was different, right? But it was, at least in the Canadian Arctic, it was an Arctic without a summer. The melt never even came, right? Because of all these particulates in the atmosphere. And we would have storms like this blowing through, things like that. And, where's this global warming people are talking about, right? We didn't even have a melt season, right? And then even later, like in 1993, I published this paper in a journal called Nature. It's one of these big, prominent journals, where we were looking at temperature records across the Arctic. And this is what we said. We do not observe the large surface warming trends predicted by models. Indeed, we see cooling in some areas. I was definitely a skeptic here. I'm thinking, what the heck's going on here, right? Where's this warming we're supposed to be talking about? But this is what the data was showing. But as that was happening, hints were emerging. One of them, a warming Arctic Ocean. Some spotty evidence that the Arctic Ocean might be starting to warm up. Some of the first evidence came from this, from an oceanographer, Klaus Detlef. It's been all over the world. You see, here he is. He's a German oceanographer, but he works with the Swedes, and he was on Russian icebreakers. That's sort of the internationalism that you see in science, the actual, despite all our political differences as far as science goes, we pretty much all get along. But in any case, back in the early 1990s, that's when the Soviet Union broke up. And one of the things they were doing to try and get cold, hard cash was taking out tourists on their big nuclear-powered icebreakers. The Rossiya is one of them, right? Just to get some cold, hard cash. They'd have these moneyed tourists, and they'd take a trip to the North Pole or something like that. But then they'd bring along a token scientist, right? Detlef got on that. And he did these little measurements, and he found that there was some warming in the Arctic Ocean going on compared to earlier observations. Wasn't much, and it was just one set of observations, but it was intriguing. And then more evidence came in. Guy John Walsh I've been working with for years. He looked at this record of sea ice that we have based on satellite data and earlier forms of information before that. And he was saying that, the sea ice extent, that's that floating sea ice cover, seems to be starting to decline in summer. Not big. The record is short. But there's something up there. And he also looked more closely at these temperature patterns. Eh? Warming in some areas, but still cooling in others. So I looked at this, and I'm like, that's very interesting, okay, but still, all right, this is just, we don't need to raise the specter of greenhouse gases here. This is still just a natural variability thing, as far as I could see, right? But then the plot starts to thicken a few years later. So what happened first? And notice that warming in the Arctic Ocean, what we call the Atlantic layer. The Atlantic layer lies below the surface layer. It's about 300 meters depth, like 600 feet down, something like that. Well, more than that, some about maybe 600 feet. And there were a bunch of other cruises that went up there, oceanographic cruises, from the Swedish icebreaker Odin, the USS Pargo, other research cruises, confirmed that warming. Indeed, it was starting to warm up. So that's the Odin on the left. Right? The bottom is the Pargo. The Pargo is a submarine. It was an old Sturgeon-class submarine. Now, remember that, of course, we've been operating submarines, as have the Russians, for years underneath there. And occasionally, on these U.S. subs, they would allow room for scientific studies and things like that, even have civilians on board with some of these ones back then. But that's where some of these data came from. So suggestions that it was warming. And, well, one of the key things about climate science, one of the important parts of climate science, is what we call paleoclimate science. That is to look at climates in the past, to try and reconstruct climates of long ago, before the instrumental record. Because it's very important, if you're going to say something about the present climate and how it might be changing, you want to be able to put that in the context of what was in the past. This is what John Overpeck and his colleagues did. And in 1997, they came up with this paper that said over the past 400 years, the 20th century Arctic, okay, was the warmest. Right? It was the warmest. So it got people thinking, huh, despite all this natural variability going on, overall, you know, these ups and downs and temperature going on, overall, the 20th century seems to have been the warmest of at least the past 400 years. And he did a bunch of calculations on this, and he said, well, this is best explained by a rise in carbon dioxide levels. Now, it didn't prove that, you know, we were seeing greenhouse warming, but it certainly started to get some people thinking that may be the case, okay? But things were still spotty. Well, what was going on with the sea ice? This guy, Drew Rothrock, University of Washington, right? Looked at submarine sonar data. I had to mention these submarines, okay? Now, one of the things they were doing on these submarine cruises is they had an upward-looking sonar on them, okay? So they'd have this sonar looking up, and they could assess the draft of the ice. That's how much of the ice sticks down below the surface. Remember, 9/10 of the iceberg is below the water. Same thing with sea ice. Same thing with an ice cube, right? That's because the density of water is 9/10 that of density of ice is 9/10 that of water. Right? Now, this submarine data was collected not because there was thinking that some crazy scientist would want to look at it years later. It was primarily a safety issue back then, right? If they got into trouble and needed to surface up there, they needed to find a lead in the ice, an opening in the ice, or a place that was thin so they could pop through. So it was largely that. But we were able to get a hold of a lot of these data. And this is what it was showing. So he compared sea ice draft data, right, back from early cruises, 1958 through 76, with more recent ones, collected 93 to 97. Right? Now, 1953 to 76, of course, 1958, that's the Nautilus. That was the United States' first nuclear submarine, and it was carrying sonar, and we got a hold of that data. He was able to get a hold of that data. So it provided some early records. And the key here is just look at the difference between the bars. Now, these bars are showing this draft for different parts of the Arctic Ocean. The one right in the middle is the North Pole, so just look at that one. The red bar is a lot shorter than the blue bar. That was saying at the North Pole, these data were showing that draft might have been 3.5 meters, like more than 10 feet of ice, right? And it had thinned to less than 2.5 meters in the more recent period. And it was consistent across all these regions, these big reductions, okay? So, wow, maybe things really are changing in the Arctic. But then along comes this study by this guy, Jim Hurrell. He says, well, all right, yeah, things may be changing, but there's no need to invoke greenhouse warming. It's all this thing called the Arctic, it's all this thing called the North Atlantic Oscillation. What the heck is this, okay? All right, I just mentioned how, like, you can have, like, a run of a few winters here where you're cold and snowy with nor'easters and another one that's, you know, warmer and maybe rainy, right? That's the natural variability, okay? And how is that natural variability expressed? Well, it has to do with shifts in wind patterns, right? What we call the atmospheric long waves. You can get them in one kind of position, and you're right in the storm track that winter. You shift it a bit, okay, you're not in that storm track, right? Well, what he was really showing was that this big thing called the North Atlantic Oscillation, which is just one of these big scale patterns of atmospheric circulation variability that turns out to have a big effect on the Arctic. And he found, okay, that over like a 30-year period, this North Atlantic Oscillation had shifted such that it favored a warming Arctic and such that it favored a loss of sea ice. So here we are saying, well, is this natural climate variability? Is this global warming? This guy comes back and says, well, no, it looks like natural variability to me. So while all this is happening, we're still not clear what was going on. It got even thicker a while ago when this smart guy, Dave Thompson, he was then a postdoc at University of Washington, said that, well, even the North Atlantic Oscillation is just part of something much, much bigger called this Arctic Oscillation, right? And basically this Arctic Oscillation, a big-scale pattern of variation in atmospheric circulation, had shifted to a regime that favored this warming Arctic, right? So no need to invoke the specter of the greenhouse gases. Still, we're talking like 1998 when this study came out. Still a lot of uncertainty. And I was certainly one of the ones that wasn't convinced. So in the year 2000, I got together with a bunch of prominent scientists, very well-known ones, and we tried to put together all this evidence for a changing Arctic and tried to understand it. Let's put it all together and tell us, you know, what's it saying, right? And this is what we said in this paper. In the year 2000, we say, well, these results paint a reasonably coherent picture of change, in other words, changes in sea ice, changes in temperature, but their interpretation as signals of enhanced greenhouse warming is open to debate. We still weren't convinced, even in the year 2000, or I certainly was, and these are all very prominent signs, we still weren't convinced, right? But there was an epiphany. Not long after. That's a bunch of us up in the field. I think I'm third from the left over there. That it's more than natural variability. So here's what I recall telling myself around 2002, 2003. We talked about this North Atlantic Oscillation thing and this Arctic Oscillation thing. I said, well, if these patterns kind of regress back to where they were, okay, in a pattern that doesn't really favor the warming or the loss of sea ice, and we still start to see it warm, we still start to see the sea ice decline, that's one of the things that'll turn me. So it would be saying that some background signal had emerged from this noise of the natural variability. That is exactly what happened. It's exactly what happened. And it was sometime around 2003 for me. That was the year. That was the year where the weight of evidence became so strong that I had to say, okay, here we are, you know, welcome to the brave new Arctic. And since then, there's been really a series of rude awakenings. One of them, September 2007, when we had this record low sea ice extent. Now, we'd had records before. We had a record low in 2005, and we were pretty excited about that. Then 2007 comes along, and it didn't just beat the old record, it completely blew it away. And all through that summer, you had scientists from around the world just wrapped in front of their computer screens looking at what was happening to the ice, where through the summer, huge chunks of it kept getting eaten away. We'd never seen anything more like it before. And as I say, it just blew the old record away. And it was probably an event, I would say, after 2007, nothing was the same again. It probably removed any shred of doubt by any climate scientist that the Arctic is radically changing at this point. And there were people who were saying, even then, well, you could not have an event like 2007 again, right? It would be 100 years till you see something like that. 2012 came along, blew the 2007 record out of the way, okay? So things are changing fast. I talked about that issue of Arctic amplification, right? That idea that as things warm up, the Arctic's going to warm up the most, right? The one on the left is that figure I showed you before, going through 1987, warming, cooling, natural variability. The one on the right takes the more modern period, 1987 to 2016. There's a lot of red there, right? It's getting very warm, and where's the warmth maximized? The Arctic. just as we expected it would. So it was an incredible example of theory saying this should be happening, and the observations coming along and saying, yep, that's just what we see, right? So where are we now? There's a lot of wild cards out there. You may have heard of this one, it's been in the papers, about this argument that a warming Arctic could actually affect weather patterns in middle latitudes. The idea is this, is that the weather machine, how it works, is that you've got the equatorial regions heated up more strongly than the polar regions. That sets up a big temperature difference between the equator and the pole. That sets up a big pressure pattern difference in the atmosphere. And that's what drives the winds. That's what drives the weather. Whenever you see a storm going through, it's the weather's way of transporting warm air poleward and cold air equatorward. Well, if we strongly warm up the Arctic, you're basically, in a nutshell, messing with that temperature gradient. And if you mess with that temperature gradient, you can affect what we call the jet stream. So at the same time that, say, Philly is under a deep freeze in the winter, it's so warm in Alaska that they can't start the Iditarod, things like that. Stuck weather patterns, very, very controversial. Probably the most controversial issue in, say, climate science right out there right now, one of the most. There's some scientists who are saying, Jen Francis from Rutgers, for example, saying, yes, I think so. I think it's already here. I see evidence it's already happened. Other scientists are saying, not so fast, right? But this is probably where one of the big areas of research right now, and this is one of these areas, things where, you know, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic, right? It can actually influence down here. Permafrost carbon cycle feedback. There's another one, right? We have all this carbon in the Arctic, okay? We have all this permafrost in the Arctic. It's a lot of carbon in those soils, frozen peatlands, things like that. The issue here is that you warm up that permafrost, you start to thaw it, the microbes in the soil, little critters in the soil, become active, okay? They start breathing. What do they breathe out? Carbon dioxide and methane. And so that increases the load of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and causes an even further warming. Questions out there. When will it kick in? If it kicks in, will it be something small or will it be something really big? We don't know. Right? We don't know. But here's just yet another thing is telling us what happens in the Arctic matters. Right? In more ways than one, geopolitics, right? U.S. national interests, U.S. Navy put out a new roadmap, Arctic roadmap, to cover the period 2014 to 2030, right? They need to be able to respond to a new Arctic. I've talked to people from the Navy. They say, I don't care why the Arctic is losing its sea ice. All I know now is that I have a blue ocean I didn't have before. I have to deal with it, right? They're on board with this. President Obama issued an executive order back in 2015 enhancing coordination of national efforts in the Arctic. There's a lot of national efforts in the Arctic, NOAA, NASA, all interested in the Arctic, but let's coordinate better. Let's coordinate our science and activities up there. And where some of this is coming from is things like resource extraction. There's a lot of oil and natural gas at the bottom of the Arctic, right? And if the prices are right, we'll go after it. Vladimir Putin is going after it, right? Russian capabilities are way ahead of ours. They're already doing a lot of development in the Arctic. We've got reserves or resources like in the Chukchi Sea. Remember, I think it was Royal Dutch Shell went up there a few years ago, right, with that big rig. And they left saying they were disappointed. Well, of course, oil prices were like $40 a barrel back then. What does that need to be for it to be profitable? If it's profitable, they'll be back. Right? Now, there's a certain irony here, right? Well, we're losing the sea ice, and now we can drill for more oil and natural gas, so I understand that, okay? But it is what it is, right? This is what people are thinking. There's how this starts to get intertwined into geopolitics, resource extraction, right? Who owns the Arctic Ocean? And some of this comes from a resurgent Russia. Right, so I mentioned Vladimir Putin is all over this. The Northern Sea Route, which is one of those mythical shortcuts, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, right? Well, along the Russian coast. The other one's the Northwest Passage, right? The Crystal Serenity, remember, went through there last summer, two summers in a row. Big luxury cruise ship went there. Yeah. Well, Amundsen went through the Northwest Passage. He first conquered it in 1904, but it took him 2.5 years to get through it, right? So it's a little different right now. But the Northern Sierra, so what's Russia going to do? Put up a toll booth in Murmansk, something like this, right? These are these issues that are playing out now in terms of Arctic change. So here's where we are, and I think to end this, that go back to those two little ice caps. In the grand scheme of climate change, these are just inconsequential victims, you know, of a melting Arctic, right? But when I saw those things disappear, they may survive one or two more years. That's what really hit me. You know, I think that the loss is really personal at that point. So I do hope to get up there someday just to at least see what was there. There is an old cache there with half a bottle of Jameson's whiskey still there. I know that, okay? So that might be enough reason to go. But, you know, I think at least they do deserve some kind of a burial. So with that, thank you very much. So questions, any questions? Yeah, in the front here.
So look, thank you very much for that. That was full of fascinating information. My question will sound critical, but it's actually not meant that way. I'm interested, so part, it seems to me, of what you're doing is looking back on your own career as a scientist and saying, look, I was wrong, it turns out, and trying to understand and make sense of why it, how that could have been. And I want to know whether there is a little bit more self-criticism that would be possible. I remember myself sitting in a class in 1965 by Roger Revelle, who at the time indicated that they had been sending balloons up into the atmosphere over Hawaii, had collected the carbon dioxide, and that it was increasing. This is in 1965, and he said if it continues to increase, and he drew a graph of the temperature change, he already saw it a long time ago. He was not the only one. And so the real question is was there something wrong with your philosophy of science that you hung so much on the empirical results while the models were predicting something else? Or and why was one so skeptical in one direction rather than the other?
I think the way I always saw this, even when I was coming into grad school, for me it was not really a question of if we would see the climate warm in response to the rising concentrations of greenhouse gases. I mean, the Keeling curve started in 58, right? And people have been doing all kinds of measurements there. It wasn't a question really of if, because the physics were solid. Jim Hansen came out with, you know, early papers on this, right? It was a question of whether we had seen it yet. And that's largely where my skepticism came in. Not that I didn't see the physics and where it was going, but it was a question, is it here yet? And the answer for a long time to me was no. And that's because it was well hidden by this natural variability. Now, in terms of self-reflection, I think an important point is to go the other way on this, is that there is a tendency, I think, even among some climate scientists, and I've been guilty of this myself, okay, to overplay things, to over-sensationalize things at times. Okay? You know, in other words, every extreme event that hits, right, oh, it's climate change. And that's not right, okay? Often it is not. Often, I mean, sometimes just bad luck happens, right? And I think as a group, scientists need to be more careful in this respect, and sticking with the facts, sticking with the science. You know, my view, I mean, I'll say right here, I think there's plenty of shrill on both sides. On the far left, right, oh, we're all doomed, okay? On the far right, this is all a bunch of nonsense or fake news, right? Neither of those are helpful. Neither of those are going to get us anywhere, right? We have to take a pragmatic view of what has happened and take pragmatic steps forward. But going back to your original question, yeah, it was not really a question of if. It was more a question of when. Now, having said that, I know a whole lot more about the physics today than I knew back then, so I've learned a lot myself.
My question is about those feedback mechanism. So you highlight some of the feedback mechanism that when the ice cap gone, then the land absorbed heat rather than reflecting it. When there was ice. And so is the permafrost wildcard. So do you feel that going forward, we already passed the point that, you know, all this feedback effect will sort of continue on the trend, even though we're not emitting any greenhouse gas, that, you know, all the ice cap will melt, Greenland will go, Antarctica will go on?
Well, the feedbacks are key, okay? If you look at the biggest uncertainty in climate change right now, how warm it's going to get, right? A lot of it has to do with these feedbacks because we still need to go a long way to understand them, I think, okay? It bears on something what you call climate sensitivity, okay? But the thing about feedbacks is that they can be reversed, okay? In other words, if you can get a handle on greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere, the Arctic sea ice would come back, okay? Because the feedback actually goes the other way as well. One of the most important feedbacks out there actually is water vapor feedback, that you warm it up for a little bit, okay? Now you put more water vapor in the atmosphere, but water vapor is the most abundant greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, but that furthers the warming, okay? Now that can happen pretty quick, but if you could cool things down a bit, that water vapor comes out, you start to cool down again. So I think the point I'm trying to make here is that the Arctic, anyhow, could recover. And parts of it, you know, like the sea ice, could actually recover fairly quickly. At some point, the feedbacks can't just run away with themselves because there's other negative feedbacks that kick in. For example, if things start to get really warm, that means the Earth radiates to space at a higher temperature, and that's a cooling mechanism, right? So if these positive feedbacks were the dominant thing all the time, the climate would run away with itself, but it doesn't, okay? But they are very important, these feedbacks, and I'd say that's probably one of the biggest unknowns out there in terms of just how warm it's going to get and how quickly we're going to get there.
It's hard for anybody who lives up in the Arctic or works up in the Arctic not to be equally aghast at what's happened to the melting ice. So, you know, they just opened up the Arctic wildlife for fossil fuel drilling. And I don't know if you ever had a chance to talk to some of these guys who are going to do this drilling, but do they have any sense of consciousness about the fact that they are actually exacerbating the very, destruction of the Arctic that they're currently drilling? You know what I'm asking you?
Some do, some don't. I mean, that's been my experience. Conscience is a funny thing, isn't it? I have to be realistic. You know, there are some people who are just trying to make a living, just trying to survive, right? And, who are we to say, in a sense, okay? But if you take time to, you know, educate yourself on this, I hope that your way of thinking changes. You have some realists here in kind of funny corners, too. I mentioned like the military, right? They're all over this. They have no problem with accepting climate change for what it is because they see the facts and they accept the science for what it is. But, you know, a company like, you know, Royal Dutch Shell or something like that, you know, do they have a heart, right? Do they have a conscience, right? That's the million-dollar question. I really don't have an answer for you. I really don't.
So geopolitically, having no Arctic or no ice in the Arctic is going to change relationships between two superpowers. Mm-hmm. Is anyone looking at that from a political point of view?
Oh, yes. Oh, it's a big area of research. Now, see, I'm a geographer, right? And within geography, there's the physical geography like I do, and then there's what we call the human geography, which is the interaction of people in the landscape and things like this. And the Arctic has become this incredible test bed or this illustration, I would poster child, if you would, of how climate change and politics are becoming intertwined with each other. It's a huge body of research right now of how we're going to be able to manage this. Okay? Things like, will the United Nations Convention Law of the Sea hold? Okay? Is that framework adequate? Is it not? Right? What are oil prices going to do? Okay? If we think about more shipping in the Arctic, because it's more accessible now, through the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea Route, right? Who's going to control those shipping lanes, right? The U.S., and part of it, with respect to the Northwest Passage, says, well, this is just free passage through restricted waters. Right? Canadians are saying, no, these are our coastal waters. Now, it didn't used to matter because no one ever used to be able to get through there, right? I don't think we're going to go to war with Canada. I hope not. I'm going to Toronto next week. But But it's a huge area of research right now because it is just this incredible example of how climate change and geopolitics are just getting amazingly intertwined. So it is fascinating to watch it all unfold.
So in terms of geopolitical, you know, what's taking place right now, they're looking at that. We have the Russian subs, we have U.S. subs. But who's looking at how this is going to affect the everyday citizen, mm-hmm. whether water levels rise in Miami, Boston? I mean, who in government looks at that?
Well, not very many right now, at least in our government, right? You know, EPA's been gutted, for example. We're certainly in this nation, we seem to be still largely in a state of denial, right, about these impacts, with certain exceptions, right? The Navy, for example, very much cares about this. And they care about it because they care about port facilities, right? Shipbuilding facilities. When they say, well, why is that? Well, they're at sea level, okay? So sea level changes all of a sudden. This is a big issue to them. But no, I think we're, I think as a community, you know, we're still largely in a state of denial on this. Part of it, very deliberate, right? As I am well aware of, there is a very well organized backlash to this. I have a whole folder just labeled hate mail, you know, stuff that I get sometimes. what's it going to take? I don't know. You know, as a scientist, I'd like to think, well, let the data rule, let the facts show. Well, we've seen that that doesn't really work, right? And so this is part of the reason why I've become quite vocal right now on this issue that, hey, the Arctic is telling us a story. We better listen to what is happening to that. And I hope that it is resonating at some level, but it is a very big hill that we're trying to climb right now.
I'm a little bit frustrated with what seem to me to be easy answers, whether it's coming from one side or the other. And so it strikes me, your colleague who suggested that it was a change in the Arctic oscillation that explained the decline of ice, which you then chalked up to natural variation. So there must be some reason why that was thought to be natural variation. I mean, I immediately want to know, well, what caused that change in the oscillation?
Right. Yeah, well, in terms of trying to identify whether you're seeing a human-induced climate change, greenhouse warming, or natural variability, there are certain fingerprints you're looking for, right? Certain patterns that you're looking for. And the patterns weren't matching up as well as I would seem to like. But in terms of the cause of that shift in the Arctic oscillation, I think people are still working on that. There's been a lot of work on looking at that in terms of what was happening in terms of like sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific. The issue here, okay, is that if you just dismiss something as natural climate variability, okay, that does not absolve you from the responsibility of identifying the cause of it, okay? Because everything has a cause in the climate system. It's not like Harry Potter can just flick his magic wand and say, climate change, okay? Even natural variability has a cause to it. But the reality is it can be very difficult to identify it at times because of how complex and chaotic the climate system is. So we don't have all the answers to that. And having said saying that we don't have them all does not mean we know nothing. We know quite a bit. But just what you're getting at in this issue of identifying the cause for the natural variability, that remains one of the big challenges in climate science that a lot of people are concerned about and working on. That's probably all I can say there. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I'll be around later if you want to ask questions. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.